tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
For years, the United States has been pursuing, through salt talks and detente, the avoidance of a nuclear war with the Soviet Union, because our policy has been to try to survive in that gray area of a world where nuclear war is unthinkable, that area where we're living in the gray in-between of the war which must not be fought, and a peace which apparently cannot be achieved. But now, shockingly, we find that the Soviet Union has been pursuing apparently a far different policy, that the policy of how to wage a nuclear war and to win it. Have the Soviets behind salt talks and behind detente succeeded in actually building up not just parity, but nuclear superiority over the United States? The answer may shock you. Back in 1949, the Soviet Union exploded an atomic bomb. By 1950, we knew they had the hydrogen bomb. And from that time on, there has scarcely been a decision made in Washington that has not first been weighed in the light of what would be the possible Soviet response. As you look back in history at Korea, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and Vietnam, major United States decisions, policy decisions with regard to foreign policy, have been heavily influenced by possible Soviet reactions, as they continue to be influenced today. That bizarre scene when General MacArthur met with the president then, Harry Truman, out at Wake Island to discuss the possibilities of what appeared to be an impending war, a very wide scale in Korea. What was in the minds of those two men was apparently never spoken, because in that event, Douglas MacArthur had every intention of using tactical, if not strategic, nuclear power in the event of any communist Chinese intervention in that war. He was asked the question by Harry Truman, "Doug, what do you think about the intervention of the communist Chinese in the Korean War?" MacArthur said they will never intervene, but he meant because in his mind he would have used nuclear weapons to prevent it, or if they did, to even bomb some of the cities of China itself, not only of North Korea. Harry Truman, a pragmatist, would never have allowed nuclear weaponry to become a part of the extension of foreign policy. He never would have permitted Douglas MacArthur to have used even some of the strategic or tactical, I should say, because that's a short-range type such as a long Tom cannon and the smaller low-yield kiloton and below range nuclear weapons then available to the United States arsenal. And so, of course, the conflict developed. But, you know, at the very time that meeting in Wake Island was underway, perhaps up to 1 million men from the communist Chinese army of so-called volunteers had already advanced across the border from North Korea and entered that war and were filtering down through the valleys to become a part of the effort which finally saw the Allied forces, the United Nations forces, clear down to the very toe of that narrow peninsula. The United States has seen in these past two decades a gradual dismantlement of the large colonial empires which became relics of the past following World War II, while the United States and Britain between them controlled the shipping lanes, the sea lanes, and had the possession of the most strategic sea and land areas of the world to bottle up world shipping. And those same areas, by the way, resulted in some of the most important defensive areas in World War II, such as Midway Island, the Hawaiian Islands themselves, Great Britain having some of the most important areas in the world under her control, such as Gibraltar, Malta, the Suez Canal, the southern approaches to it at Aden, the Red Sea, all of this under British control, the Andaman and Nicobar Islands. They also had Hong Kong, and they had the Straits of Malacca. They had all of these areas bottled up completely so that the British colonial empire was virtually worldwide. It became very unpopular following World War II to have any colonial empires about, and so gradually some of those former empires of the past, the Portuguese, the Dutch, the British, and to some degree the Belgians, such as the Belgian Congo, were gradually dismantled. They were relics of the past. The new Cold War era saw increasing world pressure against such dependencies, colonies, protectorates, and the like. Oh, it wasn't that the Soviet Union didn't have its satellites, its puppet states, its dependencies, and perhaps its colonies, if you like, but somehow the free world felt it could write off all of the Eastern European nations and all the other areas where Soviet influence was being felt
such as the Middle East and other parts of the world, North Korea, Southeast Asia, and the like? And what were the trappings of the colonial empires of the past, especially that of the British Empire? Well, they were worldwide naval forces. They were bases for those naval forces abroad, in places all over the world. They were powerful fleet units, presumably to guard shipping lanes. That's always the basic reason why they are there. But, of course, eventually, those powerful naval forces become the extension of national policy, as they did in the case of Britain, and as they are now becoming in the case of the Soviet Union. Well, today, the dismantlement of those colonial empires is practically complete. India went, Egypt, the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, the East African colonies that Britain took away from Germany following World War I, Kenya, Tanzania, other nations in Africa, nations throughout the world, as cries of Uhuru in Africa, the cry of the Mau Mau for freedom in Kenya, went from nation after nation, where it seemed that those who were trying to achieve freedom, liberty, independence, would leap out of the arms of a colonial empire into the arms of a despotic dictatorship. So today, across Africa, and for that matter, in the Western Hemisphere and around the world, Marxist, Leninist dictatorships are becoming the mode of the day. A part of the dismantlement of empire still going on in Africa as recently as very, very few years ago resulted, of course, in the takeover of a leftist Marxist dictatorship in Mozambique, the former Portuguese colony right adjacent to Rhodesia. And, of course, since that time, the leader there has been fueling the guerrilla efforts at overthrow of Ian Smith's white minority regime in Rhodesia by supplying guerrillas with communist arms to wage war against helpless and innocent civilians, mostly black against black in the villages, and once in a while, of course, as you heard in the news, some whites who are about the business, of the nefarious business, of course, of a holiday in a camper trailer, who are attacked by guerrillas with Russian weapons. Well, the dismantlement of those empires is now virtually complete. It kept the cartographers and map makers very busy through the 50s and 60s as the map of the world changed continuously. And meanwhile, under cover of salt talks and on into the 70s, where arms limitation talks gave way to the feeling of the mood of détente, the Soviet Union has been gradually building up the largest colonial empire the world has ever seen. Today, the colonial empire of the Soviet Union extends to all hemispheres. It is in the West, in the form of Cuba, and many other areas in South America, and very heavily so in Mexico, where Russian and communist influence is quite strong. To the periphery of Southeast Asia, Korea, Vietnam. That is a very painful word to bring up because it was the longest, most costly, most fruitless, most absolutely unsuccessful war in the history of the United States of America. Once again, the communist influence won. It has become increasingly obvious then to United States military strategists that after World War II, the world was quite prepared, even with the possession of nuclear weapons in the hands of increasingly larger numbers of nations, principally the Soviet Union, later Britain, France, and the like, and now today, apparently, even some of the smaller nations. We think now it's very likely that Israel has the atomic bomb. India has exploded their own atomic device. Apparently, nations adjacent to those countries, Arab states and others, are going to become possessive of atomic weapons. But it's become obvious that the world was fully prepared to fight one tiresome, conventional-type struggle after another, without necessarily resorting to nuclear weapons. And so following the earlier nuclear scare of the Cold War, when the United States was seeing ads in the papers about backyard fallout shelters and the guy standing there with a gun threatening that he would shoot his neighbor if he tried to break in the event of a nuclear war, when he was trying to survive on his meager rations in his fallout shelter, we shifted our attention to the buildup of conventional forces, not only for our own protection, not only for the maintenance of large standing armies in NATO nations, as well as over in South Korea and in Japan, where we have military forces, but also the supply of conventional weapons to many other countries of the world, principally Israel. But for that matter, any other nation which comes shopping, and especially today, of course, the Arab nations, the Shah of Iran with his toys like the F-14 and other weapons systems, which are delivered oftentimes to Arab nations and others even before United States Armed Forces elements can be supplied with the same weapons. It's an unbelievable system we see now, because under the guise of salt talks, strategic arms limitation talks, and the feeling of the mood of détente. It is becoming increasingly clear that the Soviet Union, far from achieving or from following, rather, the policy of attempting to prevent nuclear war, has been following the policy of attempting to wage a nuclear war and to win it.
While people struggled through the Depression, the Plain Truth magazine was warning about European nationalism. When everyone sighed relief at the end of World War II, the Plain Truth was predicting the Middle East crisis. When Korea dominated the headlines, the Plain Truth was forecasting the formation of the common market. When the space race captured America's fancy, the Plain Truth was covering trade war and the rise of Japan, future super giant. The Plain Truth magazine examines everything from world events to family life in the light of Bible prophecy, history written in advance. To keep ahead of today's world trends, request the Plain Truth magazine. After 40 years, still ahead of its time.
Write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, or better yet, just call that toll-free number, 800-4-T-3-4444, for your free current copy of the Plain Truth magazine. This magazine dares to go behind these seemingly kaleidoscopic, difficult, almost impossible to be understood world events, and to show you the crazy quilt patchwork of world events fitting together into a biblical scheme fulfilling, believe it or not, Bible prophecy. The Plain Truth dares to go behind the news and to give understanding of world events and world news as you cannot achieve in any other publication. If you will dial the toll-free number 800-423-4444, we'll send you your free copy by return mail. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. We'll try to have it in the mail the same day or the day after. If the Postal Service will speed it up a little bit. Of course, depending upon the time of the year, that becomes difficult. And we'll get your copy to you. I hope that you'll get your name on the mailing list of the Plain Truth magazine. We're going to have articles right along the line of what I'm talking about. A lot of the statistics I'm giving you here in greater detail, showing you the actual balances between the United States naval units and the Soviet naval units and the like, showing you what is happening in this struggle behind the scenes between the communists and the free world, that the communists have actually been steadily increasing their navy to become one of the largest the world has ever seen. I heard Henry Kissinger talk in Dallas before a foreign affairs committee there of how policy decisions taken by current administrations are likely to affect the administration about 8 years on into the future, that certain decisions which may be made by U.S. policymakers with regard, for example, to the deployment of ABM systems and the appropriations of billions of dollars to do so, with regard to the shifting of policy from the buildup of massive strategic forces to the buildup of more tactical and limited forces. Now, the term strategic means the intercontinental ballistic missile systems and, of course, the nuclear submarines with their nuclear-tipped missiles that can be deployed around the Soviet Union or theirs around us. Whereas tactical might mean not only the long-tom cannons, it might not only mean long-range bombers such as our B-1 and the Soviet backfire, but it also might mean even troop-carried or portable weapons delivery systems involving lower-yield nuclear weapons. That's the way the military basically approaches the difference between tactical and strategic. A part of the SALT talks had to do with allowing the Soviet Union time to catch up in their deployment of MIRV systems, because the United States had achieved superiority in our multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles. And for short, that means MIRV. That's a system whereby an intercontinental ballistic missile can be launched high above the stratosphere, far out into space. And when it re-enters, there are several, maybe up to, I don't know how many, but maybe 10 or 20 or more, nuclear-armed warheads which can be independently targeted from the re-entry stage of that vehicle. The United States had superiority in that. So one agreement allowed the Soviet Union to catch up in MIRV, while we were supposed to be catching up in the deployment of the big super-powered booster rockets, because they were ahead of us in the gross tonnage they could lift off their launching pads. So this deadly war of nerds of the Soviet Union and the United States, possessing the power to blast about 50 worlds such as ours out of existence, to exterminate each other mutually maybe 100 or so times over, and that argument is moot. People argue whether it's 20 times over, 15 times over, or 5 times over, which is by itself obscene, because once would be quite enough. But we have been going along with this type of activity in our attempt to get the Soviet Union to approach this policy of the war of nerves between the supernuclear powers in the same way we do. That is, trying to find a way to continually achieve nuclear stalemate, so that every time the Soviet Union seems to be ahead in one respect, the United States catches up in that respect. Every time we seem to be forging ahead a little bit here, the Soviet Union is able to catch up in that area. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union was going about the business of building up one of the largest navies the world had ever seen. It already has the world's largest standing army. It is way ahead of us in many important areas. And I want to give you a little bit of a statistic on that. It so happens that the book called Jane's Fighting Ship, you've heard about that. That is actually looked upon by the government as the most authoritative source for documentation of naval strength, not only of the United States, but of other countries around the world. It's a standard reference of the world's navies. And it said in its 1976 and 77 edition that the Soviet Union now has 3 times as many submarines as the United States and has started to challenge America's long-standing supremacy in aircraft carriers by building flat tops, the first two of a planned fleet of 6 40,000-ton Kiev-type aircraft carriers. Those would mostly be committed to helicopter-type carriers, but nevertheless, the United States remains predominant so far in aircraft carriers. Captain John Moore, who was the book's editor and a former deputy chief of British Naval Intelligence, said, and I quote, "When in the past a country of a few overseas financial or colonial interests has embarked on the building of a considerable fleet, the true aims of the ships concerned have proved to be not only the protection of the homeland and the sea lines of communications which run to it, but also aggressive activities designed to support national policy." Now keep an eye on what's happening over in the other part of the world too, where the very, very delicate lifeline of the bicycle economy of the true super giant of industry following World War II of Japan has got to be maintained and kept open by a growing Japanese Navy. I said a delicate lifeline and a bicycle economy. I merely mean by that that about 90-some percent of all the raw materials, most importantly fossil fuels and oil, which have got to come flowing into Japan, have got to come there from thousands of miles away over the sea lanes of the world, from the Persian Gulf, from North Africa, from Central and South America, from the United States, from other areas. And, of course, the Japanese are the builders of the largest and most sophisticated ships the world has ever seen in the form of their huge 200,000-ton deadweight supertankers, computerized fully and able to ply through the seas with a crew of only about 15 men. So the Japanese will be building warships to go along with some of those merchant vessels. You can absolutely depend upon it. As you see, a new struggle today, almost like that which was before World War II, in the buildup of conventional forces around the world. Now, we have known for many years that the Soviet Union was gradually increasing their presence in the Mediterranean. We have known that the Sixth Fleet was being outmoded and outclassed, that U.S. ships were 20 to 30 years old and older, that the Soviet Navy was putting ships off the waves at a tremendous rate, that they have brand new cruisers that are very fast, that are missile carrying and the like, and you begin to wonder about that Soviet Navy. Well, recently a book published by the Commander-in-Chief of the Soviet Navy has exploded the myth that the Soviets have built a naval strength only for their own self-defense. Moscow's protestations that the Soviet Navy's global role is exaggerated by the West are now absolutely proved to be false by the book by Admiral F.G. Gorshkov, who is Commander-in-Chief of the Soviet Navy. His book, which is called The Maritime Power of the State, is a candid statement of intent. It will for a long time remain the basic work of reference for all students of Soviet naval power and a Bible for Russian students of the political use of sea power. And the goals are frankly stated in plain language in this book for the first time, things that Western observers have long suspected, they have long charged or accused, and the Soviets have denied are now plainly in print in Gorshkov's book. He states, frankly, that the aim of the Soviet Navy is global supremacy at sea. It is not enough, he argues, for the Soviet Union to develop naval strength in order to join the ranks of world powers. Nothing less than domination of the world's oceans will be accepted. And today, you can see Russian nuclear submarines ringing both coasts of the United States, Atlantic and Pacific. You can see them up underneath the polar Arctic ice cap. You can see them in the Gulf of Mexico, the Sea of Japan, the South China Sea, the Yellow Sea, the Indian Ocean, the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea, and everywhere else for that matter, because they have three times as many submarines as we do. And they have growing surface units that are outclassing ours because they are newer, more modern, and capable of delivering quite a punch. So they say nothing less than domination of the world's oceans can be accepted. Now he argues from four main premises. Gorshkov says first, it is necessary to develop such naval strength as to deprive the oceans completely of the protective role which they have hitherto afforded the United States. Rather ominous words when you think back to that pre-World War II time when the United States could feel so totally protected simply by the vastness of the oceans that separated us from Asia and Europe and from the fact of World War II. The attack by the Japanese upon Hawaii, and then the Battle of Midway, which was a dramatic turning point in the Pacific, and our island hopping, where war never really came to America's shores except in a little bit of a sporadic attempt by the Japanese to float balloons over, or maybe a once in a while shelling from a Japanese submarine at night that did little, if any, damage at all. For all practical purposes, those oceans have not only given us a tremendous protection, but they have contributed to a large measure to the feeling of isolationism, and therefore to one extent or another have even influenced national policy and national politics. Now this Soviet admiral, the commander-in-chief of their navies, has said their buildup is to deprive the ocean surrounding the United States of the protective role which they have hitherto afforded us. In a moment I'm going to show you that our deployment of the ABM system, which has long since been abandoned, which cost us uncounted billions of dollars, that our miscalculation in the development of massive strategic weapon systems, and especially our deployment of the Minuteman system, calculated to bring about swift retaliation in the event of Soviet aggression against the populace of the Soviet Union, to let them know that if they embark on a nuclear war, there are unacceptable consequences, that immediate and swift retaliation has been our policy, and that the Soviet Union has now apparently achieved a breakthrough which will render our Minuteman deployment absolutely useless. I believe you ought to be terribly concerned about some of the things I'm saying on this program. There are things that haven't been said in world news magazines and haven't been revealed in the press. Where do you think I got the information? But the point is that if you read your copy of the Plain Truth magazine, you will see not only the news, but what is behind the news from the perspective of, believe it or not, Bible prophecy. The Soviet Union is identified in the Bible. So is the United States. So is Britain. So is West Germany. So are all the other major powers of the world. And Bible prophecy isn't a lot of tea leaf reading or crystal ball gazing about little picky points and dates, months and days and weeks, but it does have a great deal to say about the overall world trends with which we are dealing in this program and in articles in this publication, The Plain Truth. All you got to do is pick up the telephone and dial that toll-free number, 800-423-4444, for your free copy. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. We'll get it in the mail by just as quickly as we can and have it on its way to you, and it's absolutely free of charge. There is no price whatever. Well, the admiral of the Soviet Navy had four major points he wanted to make that I haven't completed before I tell you what the Soviet Union has been doing about civil defense and whether or not we ought to be concerned about it and whether or not the administration in Washington ought to be very terribly concerned about it. His second point was that he said the Soviet Navy must be in a position to play a very big role in local wars. Interesting, isn't it? So far, the United States has always assumed quite a role. In Korea, for example, the 7th Fleet was offshore. In Vietnam, same comment. When something flares up in the Middle East, immediately the United States sends a carrier and some other escort vessels to stand offshore. One reason, of course, is always that there are usually U.S. citizens involved. Perhaps there may have to be evacuation, as in Lebanon, as in Angola, or elsewhere. Perhaps there is also the rather obvious geopolitical overtone of U.S. strength or of U.S. presence spotter planes see it, the newspapers publish it, and everyone knows the United States flag is offshore with thousands of men and armed to the teeth with supersonic jet aircraft aboard U.S. naval vessels. It's quite a little bit of an exercise of geopolitical use of power. The Soviet Union recognizes that, so of course now they're going to embark on the same thing. As for using the Soviet Navy for purposes of pure blackmail, Gorshkov argues that the mobility and flexibility of the Navy should be utilized to exert impact on coastal countries. So that plainly is stating that Soviet naval presence should exert influence on the politics of various countries around the world. I'm going to have to hurry to tell you the rest of this, so I'm going to cut off what Gorshkov says, but his book is unbelievably revealing. This was published, by the way, in a Daily News Digest, a research publication in England, in July of 1976, if you want a reference on it. The Soviet Union has gained a lead, despite nuclear ballistic weapons treaties, and has gained a superiority in strategic weapons, believe it or not. What is ahead? Obviously, the Kremlin's aim is to get into a position to be able not just to avoid a nuclear war by retaining the present very nerve-wracking position of nuclear stalemate, but trying to get into a position to be able to fight a nuclear war and to win it if war starts. The United States is still operating on the idea that nuclear war is unthinkable, that human beings are, we hope, sane, and therefore that no sane human individual would embark on a nuclear war. I'm merely asking, can we afford to assume that the Soviet Union would not start a nuclear war any further? These ominous breakthroughs that we're reading of and hearing about in the Soviet Union, not only in their strategic capability, but in their defensive capability and the massive outpouring of funds for civil defense, at the same time, with massive buildup of conventional forces, the admission by Admiral Gorsky of the Soviet naval role in exerting Soviet influence as they, under cover of detente, under cover of salt talk, under cover of the world public opinion of the past several decades against the British, against the Dutch, against the Belgians, against the Portuguese, get out of colonies, have no protectorates, have no satellites, no dependencies. World colonial empires are things of the past. They are relics of the pre-World War II days. The Soviet Union has succeeded in building the greatest world colonial empire this world has ever known, and is building the naval forces to protect it, to preserve it, and to enlarge it. What are we in the United States doing about it? Well, we're manufacturing some of the world's most sophisticated weapons, like the F-14 that can climb to over 98,000 feet in 3.5 minutes. And then we're giving them away, or selling them, to the Arabs. Before, we're giving the same kind of weapons to our own armed forces. I think you need your name on the mailing list of a very, very profoundly important magazine called The Plain Truth. It gets behind these and other ominous developments in the world scene of geopolitics and the struggle for supremacy between the world superpowers and tells you exactly where we are and where we're headed from here. You can dial right now that toll-free number, 800-423-4444, for your free copy. 800-423-4444. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, for your free copy. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.